Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome, and it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Yaakov Trump, who's the rabbi of the Young Israel Lawrence Cedarhurst. As you sort of heard, Rabbi Trump actually served in the Kol HaMitzion in Chicago for a couple of years. I assume that's how you know each other. Rabbi Trump has apps on the Nachs and the Y'utori service on the Beit Din for Geirut, the RCA Beit Din for Geirut. He grew up, as you heard, in Johannesburg, has a BA in mathematics, and has passed many of his actuarial exams, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to Torah Motion. Vakasha, Rabbi Trump.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Rabbi Kelman. And thank you, I have to tell you, on a Thursday night, 53 people joining together to learn Torah is quite something, I have to say. So I really thank you for the opportunity, and I hope that we can spend our time in a way that appreciates the time. I appreciate everybody taking the time, and let's think together. I'd like to think together about an idea, which to me is very meaningful, and I'd like to expand on it together. So let's start at the very beginning. You know, sometimes I'll tell you the development of an idea is sometimes you find an idea, you see an idea, and it's particularly meaningful, but it's an idea which is sort of textual, and then suddenly you start realizing that the idea isn't just an idea in text; it's an idea in life. It really has impact on the way you live and the way you don't live, and the decisions you make and the decisions you don't make. And this is an idea for me that really resonated in that way, because this started off as simply a fascinating parallel in text, and then it developed into something which is really a question about even the way one walks. So let's start together. Let's start at the very beginning, and we're gonna move our way through essentially three episodes, three what seem to be unrelated episodes. In life, in our Jewish history, and how they converge together today in a very meaningful and a very special fashion. So obviously, we're just before Parashas Zohar. We're just at the Purim, the cusp of Purim. So there's a lot of Purim in the air, in the atmosphere. Yet I think in order to get there, we need to start a little earlier. So I'll tell you, I'm going to share with you one of my passions is, one of my many passions is Nach. I love learning Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So, and one of the reasons for that is because is that when we all get up to Shemaim at 120 years, Hashem's going to ask us and he's going to say to us, you know, so did you read my book? And we'll say, oh, you know, we had these great vortlach on the parasha at the Shabbos table, and he'll say, but what about my book? And you say, well, there was great Torahs in Hamodia and Jewish Action and the local newspapers. They have great columns. And he said, but what about my book? So I feel it's important for us to learn his book. And there's three parts to that book, and we generally get a little bit of interaction with the first part of that book, the Torah, but the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, the Nach, is something which we don't. So I'm trying to be re-educating myself, and I've been enjoying myself very much on that journey. It actually started off teaching in Chicago. That was where I started with a woman's shir there, and since then, haven't been able to let go. In fact, I'm very proud, like Kelman just mentioned, is that just released an app on Nach Yomi, on 10-minute podcasts. And it's really just trying to get our way through Tanakh. So I'd like to share with you a particular idea that emanates from Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So we're going to start from episode one, and if it's all right, I'm going to share my screen. I did send to Rabbi Kelman the source sheets, but I'm going to do a little bit of screen sharing. Now there is a little bit of text, but I don't want to get bogged down in it, but I do want to be able to have the text speak for it by itself. Our first episode is going to take us through the episodes of Shaul HaMelech, the first king of Israel. Now, we hear pieces and bits of information, and this week we're going to hear in the Haftorah about a very interesting episode with Shaul HaMelech. But I'd like to go back and trace our way back to the beginning of when he actually became a king. And it's quite an unusual circumstance. So let's try to put ourselves in his place for a moment. The nation of Israel at this point in time are not actually used to a system of governance which relates to monarchy. The way it's worked up till now is that really there's been a leader who emerges, whether it be militarily or just through virtues and sheer charisma. And that leader will lead the generation and be a magnetic force to be able to bring them in the right direction. So we meet many of those leaders through the book of Shoftim, and we meet Othniel ben Kenaz and Ehud ben Gera and Gidon and Yiftach and all these wonderful leaders throughout Jewish history. And that takes the course of about 369 odd years. But at a certain point, when Shmuel Hanavi, who's the last of these leaders, of these judges, what they're called, when he comes to the point where he's now growing older, the people say to him, look, who's going to fill your shoes? Not your children. Your children aren't worthy. We want to have a king. And Shmuel Hanavi takes this very badly. First of all, personally, it's a rejection of him and his we'll call it system of government. But then also there's also the fact that this is not the right time theologically for asking for a king. Okay. So be it as it may, this is what goes on. And for those who are familiar with the story, the next thing that happens is Hashem tells Shmuel, I'm going to bring you the man. I'm going to give you the man who's the king. And so it happens there's this young man, Shaul, very strapping, young, tall man. He's looking for his donkeys. He comes his way into an area where Shmuel is, and Shmuel meets him and anoints him as a king. Now, at this point in time, we have to realize that the narrative is closed to the rest of Israel, meaning to say we as the reader know behind the scenes that Shaul has become king, but the rest of the nation of Israel does not know it. I'd like to walk us through together the episode in which Israel become known, or it becomes known to them who this candidate is for king. So here we go. Here are the verses that tell us about it, the psukim. We're going to look at this. We're using the translation over here is JPS 1917 translation, which is wonderful and very helpful. We're going to be looking at these psukim. So here we go. You can imagine this. Imagine you receive the invitation. It's the first coronation of the king of Israel, but there's no name. Right, you don't know who it's going to be. So you get to the ceremony, and everybody's on the edge of their seats, and Shmuel Hanavi gets up on the podium, and you can imagine there's an empty seat next to him for whoever he's going to bring onto the stage as being the king, but you don't know who it is. So what happens? Shmuel now gets off the stage, and he says, you wanted a king, and he talks about, he reprimands them. And then after this long speech of reprimanding, he comes along, and this is what happens. So he starts walking to the different tribes, and you can imagine every tribe has its sections. So there's probably 12 different sections in the audience, you know, where we can sort of imagine maybe like a Verizon Center kind of setup. For those who've ever, you know, went to the APAC a few years ago, you know, there's, you know, it's everybody seated around the sides, and he goes in the one direction. He moves off to one block of the audience, and that's the tribe of Binyamin. He comes to the tribe of Binyamin, to its different families. Then he comes to the Matri family. He comes to the seat of Shmuel. And you can imagine as this is going on, imagine the tension, you know, Shmuel Hanavi is walking through the crowds, you know, and I don't know if you've ever been in an audience, Lahavdil, when a magician is looking for a volunteer and you just don't want to be that person. And they start walking in your direction and you kind of sort of, you know, slowly melt down so nobody looks at you. So Shmuel Hanavi is walking into the audience now, and everybody's looking, and he comes up to the seat of Shaul HaMelech, who is not just Shaul to everybody else at this point in time. And it's amazing. His seat is empty. It says Shaul on the seat, but there's nobody in the seat. It's amazing. So what happens? And he has to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hashem. Where's the man? I anointed him the other day. So where is he? Vayomer Hashem, hinehu nechbo el hakelim. Hashem sends the message. He's hiding. He's in the closet at the back, right? He's not here right now. Okay. So obviously Shaul was also not so keen on this whole thing, even though he knew what the end game was. Vayarutzu vayikachu misham. They pull him out. Shaul is an extraordinarily large person. In fact, the idiom of a head and shoulders above the rest comes from this very verse. He was a head and shoulders above the rest. So you can imagine that it's so funny. It's a sort of this irony. On the one hand, he is hiding. He's humble. He doesn't want to be seen. But you pull him out and you can't help but see him, right? And he walks out and he's clearly this large, strapping man. And Vayomer Shmuel al kol ha'am, hari yisem asishar bocha bo Hashem ki ein komohu b'chol ha'am. Have you seen this man? There's no one like him. Vayariu kol ha'am, everybody calls out, Vayamru Yechi HaMelech. God save the king. I'm not sure if it was done to the British tune. I don't know, maybe this is adopted later on. Nonetheless, Canadians can appreciate this at least. You know, the Queen's still on the coin. You know, South Africa was at least kicked off the Commonwealth in the 1960s. Okay, but nonetheless, this is the first time that Israel's ever been able to see this. Okay, fantastic. It's a little bit of an awkward situation, right? He has the king, but he wasn't quite there. He wasn't really ready for this. Now, everything seems fine and dandy. Everything's going to go well. However, now Shmuel says, by the way, here are how kings work. Because remember, this system of government has not been in place right now. We've had Shoftim. Shoftim have a limited sphere of control. A king, as Shmuel had warned the people, have a much more, you know, extensive sphere of control. They can take control of anything and everything they want of your possessions. So he writes that all down for posterity, and this is the rule book of it. And Vayishalach Shmuel as Kolam, and Shmuel releases everybody to their houses. Okay, so at this point in time, we will say everybody lives happily ever after, but not quite. V'gam Shaul halach lebeit zoi giv asa. So Shaul returns to his house in Geva. Geva is one of the prime cities in Binyamin. V'yalchu imoy hachayil asher naga elokim b'leibam. And there's certain people who are inspired and they go with him and they're, Shaul, we're with you. This is amazing, incredible. And here's the sad part. U'b'nei bli'al omru. There's these people who are bli'al. Bli'al is a curious word that appears a number of times in Tanakh. It can be translated as bli'al, meaning lacking yoke. People who are a little more free, a little more, less on the straight and narrow. Sometimes it's translated as evil. The translation in JPS is here is base, right? So these are not good nicks. And by the way, every crowd has them, right? So these folks say, Ma Yoshienu ze. This guy's going to save us. I mean, he can't even sit in his seat, right? He's not even there when they want to anoint him. And they didn't, and while everybody else was giving their offerings or they're paying homage to the new king, they were glaringly absent. So it didn't go down so well. But in response, Shaul HaMelech noticing this, we'll call it public defamement, nonetheless is silent. So it's an ambivalent moment. We don't know the percentages. We don't know how many people went with him to Giva and how many people ignored him. We don't know. But we do know that it wasn't unilateral. It wasn't at this point in time unanimous. Okay, so this is the first episode of the story of Shaul. Shaul HaMelech is a king, but at this point in time, it hasn't been really a democratic process. Shaul really hasn't had the opportunity of showing who he is yet. And I'll tell you the truth. You know, a few years ago, I was the associate rabbi in the Young Israel of Lawrence Cedarhurst, and it was came time to that I was blessed to have the opportunity of stepping up to be the senior rabbi. And I reached out to a number of people, a number of mentors, friends, and I reached out to Ephraim Goldberg down in Boca. And I was just said to him, you know, tell me about your transition. Tell me about some of the things you felt were helpful in the first year. And he said an interesting thing. He said, you know, I have to tell you, one of the fascinating things which was really helpful for me was in the first year when I was rabbi in Florida, there was a large hurricane. And the hurricane gave me the opportunity of really sort of just, you know, exerting or showing leadership in a way that's meaningful, right? It allowed me to become who I was in that moment of crisis. So at the time I sort of smiled and thought, you know, well, that's all very nice. You know, we did get Sandy in New York a few years ago, but you know, hurricanes in New York are really not, you know, a matter of every half a century or so. Little did I know that in the first year it would be Corona. Now that hurricane has not yet gone away. So it's been a very fascinating process to reinvent everything. So we're really coming up on our anniversary of reinventing every Chag as we enter Purim right now. But the point of the idea is that sometimes leaders only have the opportunity of really becoming who they are through moments of crisis or through moments of trepidation, through moments of challenge. And Shaul HaMelech hasn't had that yet. At this point in time, he's been nominated, selected. Obviously, he's a very worthy person. The head and shoulders doesn't just mean to say he was tall. It also means to say in character. It's a metaphor. So he's obviously a very wonderful person, but he hasn't really had that crisis that occurred yet. So the truth be told is that's what's about to happen. The next step of the story is exactly that crisis. So here's what happens. The next chapter in Tanakh, we don't know exactly how long it is afterwards, but we were told that the nation of Israel is divided into two banks of the Jordan. The one bank is what we call the West Bank today, what we call Israel Central, the heartland. And then there's the 2.5 tribes who are living on the east bank of the Jordan. And those folks who are living on the east bank of the Jordan are Gad and Reuven and the part of the tribe of Menashe. So there's in one of those outposts, there's a city called Yavesh Gilad, very fascinating city to track throughout all of Tanakh, has a very colorful history. At this point in time, as Shaul HaMelech becomes king, they are surrounded by an opportunist whose name is Nachash. Nachash is the king of Ammon, one of the Transjordan nations. And he makes a very basic proposition to them. He says, look, I'd like you to become taxpayers to me, because might is right, at least in these days. And in order to demonstrate your allegiances to me, I have a simple medical procedure that you need to also make, which is just simply remove one of your eyes as a sign of allegiance. Right? It shouldn't be too difficult, folks, right? So just, you know, just that's going to be the way it works, or I'll just kill you all. So so they face a little bit of a difficult decision, and they come to him and they say, look, can you give us a little bit of time to find a champion? Give us somebody who can, you know, take our cause. And you can imagine sort of the tone of voice where Nachash returns to the people of Yavash Gidon, and, you know, gloatingly says, ha, 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 you know, you find anybody who can help you now, right? So obviously the military state of affairs is probably very much in the favor of the Ammonites. He doesn't believe anybody can help them. What happens is Yavesh Gilad send their messengers to the newly elected king. You can imagine, you know, sort of like, you know, he's just getting his office set up, you know, he's just getting the plaque on the door, and he gets this message, and they're like, well, they're trying to kill us across the river. So, you know, okay, so here we have our crisis. So Shaul HaMelech jumps into action. He sends a note to all of the different tribes of Israel. He pulls them all together, and now he's going to bring together this war effort to defend one of the outposts in the east. And we're told about this battle, very beautiful description here. We don't have too many details, but it's very resounding. This is the next chapter in the next source, in source two. Vayimi Macharas, it was the next morning. Vayosim Shaul is the Am Shlosha Rashim. He divides them into three different camps. So this is going to be his military formation. Vayavo B'soich HaMachaneh Ba'ashmor Es HaBoiker. He enters the camp in the morning. Vayaku Es Amon Ad Chom HaYom Vayini Shorim Yoifutsu. He conquers the Ammonites. The refugees are running away right now. V'lo Nisharu Vom Shnayim Yachad. There's not even two people who are next to each other. That's how severe a success this is. Okay. Now, here's the interesting part. So Shaul HaMelech is now sort of returning from battle. You can imagine him taking off his gloves, you know, putting his sword in the scabbard. And the first conversation that ensues is the following. V'yomer ha'omer Shmuel, mi ha'omer Shaul yimloch olenu. So he is now his folks who are most aligned and to Shaul say, who were those people the other day who questioned you being able to rule over us? Tenu ha'anashim u'nemisem. Now is a perfect time to kill anybody who questioned your leadership. Meaning, beforehand, when you hadn't had a chance to show who you were, and they thought they had an advantage of, you know, scorning you publicly, well, that's all very nice when you didn't have power. But now you have power. Now is the moment to make an example of these folks. And I'd like now, Shaul HaMelech, let's publicly execute them, and we will show people what it means to play games with the king of Israel. So this sounds like a very strong suggestion. And what ends up happening is, Vayomer Shaul, lo yumas ish bayom hazeh, no man will die this day, ki ayom asa Hashem teshua b'Yisrael. Today is a day of salvation. Nobody is going to die today. That's what Shaul HaMelech says. So this is a very powerful description here. And Shaul HaMelech is not taking advantage of what could have been a moment of success. Now, one has to ask oneself is, and I'd like you to consider the following question, which is, you know, Tanakh is not at this point in time doing any judgments. Did you notice that? Tanakh is not saying this is good, this is bad, this is neutral. And sometimes Tanakh will do that for us. But when it comes to this particular episode, then Tanakh is not saying this is good, this is bad, this is ugly. We're just being told what it is. And I wonder what the Tanakh is trying to tell us. Is this in fact a laudable action? Is this in fact a difficult action? What I'd like to do is if it's possible, I'm going to do a curious test with you. And that is, I would like to, let me just see if I can do this quickly over here. I would like to actually poll you guys. So I would like to ask everybody over here what you think about this, but we'll do it in a very simple way. Let me just get there for a moment. I'm just going to share screen with you for a, here we go. I'm going to activate this and in a second, here we go. I'm going to share screen right now. Give me a moment, sorry. It's getting the right screen here. And I would like you to share with me what you think. Okay, so here we go. Here we are. Here is the screen. What you need to do is you can go to polev.com/Rabbi Trump. Okay. And by putting in any of these codes, you're voting, is this positive, negative, or neutral? Is Tanakh telling us that Shaul's actions are being silent to in the face of his detractors? Is this positive, negative, or neutral? You can find this in a browser. It's a polev.com. That means poll everywhere. And /Trump. Or you can just text a code to 37607. And each of the yes, no, or maybes are these different codes here. Okay. Okay. This is active right now. Okay. Let's see here. By the way, it's anonymous, so you do not need to think of that. So it looks like somebody is thinking positive. Okay, let's get a little spread here, folks. It's going to give 1 minute over here just to think a little bit together. Okay. So far we're looking positive or neutral, a little more positive, folks. Let's put in some things. Let's think about this. I'm obviously not asking a question which is black or white, which is why this is complex, because in this case there are elements which are a little bit both ways, right? Is it good to be this kind of person, to be the person who doesn't respond to those detractors? Is it bad? Should he have stood up for himself? Is that perhaps a lack of self-awareness? What is Tanakh trying to tell us? Okay, so it's moving along over here. We're seeing definitely that there's some neutral, a little more hedging here. Going to give it for another 20 seconds, and then we'll come back in. We'll take a look at what the Mephoreshim to look at over here. Okay, so definitely neutral is always a safer place to be, if neutral is a possibility. Okay, so looking, I'll be getting some responses over here. I'm feeling some positive vibes, folks. I'm seeing that negatives are not getting too much over here. Okay, so I'm hearing some more negative, some more neutrals. This is another 10 seconds here. Okay, so looking negative and positive are moving towards each other. Okay. Let's hold here for a second. So just at this point in time, you feel free to add more as well. At this point in time, it's looking like we have 58% people say it's neutral. I mean, to say Tanakh's not 54% is neutral. And it looks like 31% of the people polled suggest positive and 15% suggest neutral. Okay, so these are all very important options. Let's explore them. Let's unpack them right now. Please, by the way, feel free to carry on going. I'll leave this in the background. Maybe we'll come back a look a little later. What I want to do is let's go back to some of the people who identify this. Now, let's come back to our sources for a second. It turns out that there's a very fascinating pasuk in Mishlein. This is why it's so important to learn Tanakh in context. Here's what the pasuk says: "Boz l're'eyu chasar lev." If you insult your friend, you're lacking of heart. "V'ish tivu nois," but a person of knowledge, yacharish, will keep quiet. Now, here's the interesting thing about this pasuk. You'll notice that, in fact, the two verbs in this sentence are verbs we have heard before in the same sentence. Look at the verbs here. The verb one is boz, a person who disgraces, and the other verb is yacharish, keep quiet. Could it possibly be that Shlomo HaMelech, in writing Mishlei, was using this pasuk to comment on another pasuk in Tanakh? And the answer is yes. Because let's find that other pasuk. Here it is. Ubnei Bli'al Amru, the people who didn't like Shaul at the beginning, what did they say? They said, Vayavu Zuhu, they disgraced him. That's verb number one. They didn't send him a mincha. Vayhi Kamacharesh, and he responded in silence. Is that fascinating? Could it be that Mishlei is now, in a certain sense, giving us the judgment which is absent in these psukim as to Shaul's actions? Says Rashi, absolutely. Rashi says, V'ish Tuvunos Yacharesh, when the person disgraces you, Hachasar lev, though that person is lacking of heart in the first half of the pasuk, k'moy Shaul dirsiv vayvezeu v'loy hevi'u lamincha, vayimach kamacharish, he will be silent. In other words, what is the judgment? The people who are bnei Belial are called chasar lev, they're lacking heart. Good, okay, so we know they're negative. But we are wondering about the second half. Is Shaul positive? The answer is he's called an ish tevunos, a man of knowledge. And I think we can see the positive aspect of this for a moment, meaning when you educate your children and they're in a setting, and we're not talking about an abusive setting, but we're talking about a setting where somebody's calling them names and irritating them, and they are able to maintain the equanimity and they're able to hold their own and not get too flustered while this happens, and they don't hit back or kick back or bite, you say, you know, I'm really proud of you. I'm really proud you managed to hold it. You managed to hold the line. That's what this pasuk seems to be saying. And I was, Shaul HaMelech was acting in a very human way. He was acting in a really distinguished way. He held the moral high ground. That's what the pasuk in Mishlei seems to be saying as an explanation of our original pasuk. That's on the one hand. So folks, that's speaking to those many people who said perhaps in a positive direction. However, the Gemara actually comments on this in Yuma, on Daf Chof Bez on Bez, and says this on the same pasuk, Va'amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says the name of Rav. Here we have it. Here's the English translation as well. Mipnei, the Sonsino translation. Mipnei ma ne'enash Shaul. Why was Shaul punished? Mipnei shemachal al kavodai. Because he waived his honor. Shenemar vayevizu b'nei b'li'ayel. Va'amru ma yosh ye'enu zeh. Vayevizeh v'lai v'mincha. Vayikam acharish. He was silent. In other words, what was the flaw which led to the failure of Shaul HaMelech as a king? What led to that failure was the ultimate fact that he was not able to stand up for himself, which is fascinating. So the Gemara seems to be taking it a different perspective on the same pasuk. Mishlei, Shlomo HaMelech seems to be saying, this is fantastic. This is the kind of person you want to be. You want to be an ish tevunos. The Gemara is saying that was where he was lacking as a leader. Now, by the way, I see a number of comments coming through. We'll try to miss Hashem, get to the comments at the end. I want to just make sure to keep a good train of thought here, because there's a lot of details and I'd like to see as they converge together in just a moment. But this duality, this bifurcation over here is what we were voting on a second ago. Is he neutral? Is it negative? Is it positive? You know, it's hard to see. And now you may have a question right here, which is, but wait a second. We know the reason why Shaul HaMelech was dismissed as a king. There were two incidents which led to it. One was not waiting for Shmuel to bring a carbon. The other one was not fully listening to Shmuel Anavi in the decree to eradicate the Amalek, which is what we read about in this week's Haftarah, Shmuel Aleph Perek Tezvav, where we hear about Shaul HaMelech not killing Amalek, not killing Agag. And there was that failure which led to that. So you are right, that is true. I would argue that's exactly what the Gemara is actually saying. If we just fast forward for a minute, before I apologize, I'm going to put it over here. Here we go. Here are the psukim in this week's Haftarah, which talk about the failure of Shaul HaMelech to kill Amalek. What happens is Shmuel says to him, Haloim katon ato be'enecha, you may think of yourself little in your eyes, Rosh shiftei Yisrael ato, but you're the king. Vayim shachacha Hashem le'melech al Yisrael. Hashem made you a king. You can't act like this. And I would argue that this is the same failing that the Gemara is pointing out over here. You see, this is the complexity of the situation. Shaul HaMelech really is two people. He's not just one person. On the one hand, he is a proletariat. He's Shaul, who comes from Giva. He's a young man who's a shepherd. He looks after donkeys. His father is obviously a well-known person. Kish is a regular proletariat, a regular Israelite. However, something happens in his life where Hashem sees there's more in him. And Hashem asks him to assume another role, a new hat he has to put on his head. And as he puts that new hat on his head, he now assumes different responsibilities in his new persona. So perhaps what Mishlei is saying is, as a regular individual, as the type of person you'd try to raise your child to be, that's wonderful if you keep quiet when people insult you. Obviously not abuse, and there's times to stand up for yourself. But you don't want to be that person who's always viscerally reacting to any teasing that occurs to you around. I mean, you'll never get through life. But now, Shaul HaMelech, you're not just Shaul anymore. You're a king. You wear a different hat. Once you wear a different hat, you have the responsibility to your station and your status to respond in kind as a king would. And what the Gemara seems to be saying is, on that level of persona, it was a failure, shemochal al kavodai, and that same hairline fracture widened later in his career, that when people were saying to him, Shaul HaMelech, let's go, do we really need to kill all the Amalekites? Do we need to get the animals with the king? Let's bring him back, it'll be a trophy. At that point in time, Shaul should have said, I was commanded by the prophet to do this. I'm going to do it the way I wanted. But instead, his response was, as he says, Vayomer Shaul el Shmuel, Chatasi kevarti es pi Hashem es dvarecha, I disobeyed you and God. Ki yareis yesa'am, I feared the people. Which essentially means to say is, I wasn't prepared to act above them. I wasn't going to speak top down to them. I'm a person who I value my social interaction. That over here is the difference. That is the complexity of the Shaul HaMelech episode here. We come back to our section. On the one hand, yes, it is laudable for an individual to be quiet, but it is not laudable for a king to be quiet. And that's what seems to be the dichotomy which has been set over here, which seems to be a pretty obvious resolution. But it's very important to appreciate. Now, by the way, just to think about this, the Meiri says this in the Gemara over here. We're not going to get into all the different words, but it's very worthwhile taking a look inside as well. One of the great medieval commentators, one of the Rishonim on the text in the Gemara. Now, here's an interesting thing to think about. This is not just about Shaul HaMelech. This is really true about us as well. You know, especially now during Corona, we've really seen how the actions of one group can impact all the people in those groups. You know, so, you know, when one Jew, one group of Jews acts in a particular way or doesn't act in a particular way, it impacts all of us. And sometimes we say to ourselves, you know, oh, well, I don't believe in this, or I do believe in this, and this is how I'm going to act, and this is not how I'm going to act. But we should realize that we wear the hat as a human being, as a person on this planet, and we wear the hat of being a Jew. We also wear numerous hats. We represent many different clans and tribes. And it's very important to reflect on that fact, that the decisions we make are not simply a decision of us drilling a hole in our part of the boat, it's everybody's boat as well. So this is the complexity of Shaul HaMelech over here. What I'd like to do is, let's put Shaul HaMelech for a moment on the side. This is the end of episode one. I'd like to start with a completely new story, which may seem completely dissimilar, different stage in history, but I would like to argue is the mirror parallel to what we just studied. What we're going to do is, now we're going to move forward into a new character, the next king of Israel, and his name is David HaMelech. David HaMelech actually is the son-in-law of Shaul HaMelech. He assumes he marries the daughter of Shaul, Michal, and ultimately assumes the kingship later on after Shaul HaMelech passes and Shaul HaMelech's son, Ishbosheth, also is murdered. Now, what is fascinating about this particular story is, let's just contextualize where we're at. David HaMelech, at the point in time that we're going to be studying in just a moment, is now the full king of Israel. He's respected. He's a commander of great renown. And a terrible event happens in his life. David HaMelech made a number of mistakes, or one large mistake, which had multiple ripples and repercussions. And one of the repercussions that happened in his life for a mistake that he made, for a sin which he did, is that his son, his fourth son, essentially, his name is Avshalom. And you'll probably notice there are not so many Jewish boys named Avshalom today. That's because Avshalom is not seen as a very positive character in Jewish history. Avshalom rebelled against his father, and he rallied together an army and marched upon Jerusalem to conquer Jerusalem from his own father, with his, what seemed to be intent of killing him as well. What ends up happening is that David HaMelech has a very painful decision to make, where he has to wonder whether he should defend Jerusalem against his son and his son's army, or to retreat. And although David HaMelech perhaps could have rationalized to himself, as many leaders have done in life, that it's all right, I will sacrifice a few people for my own posterity. That is not what David HaMelech decides to do. He does not want to lose Israelites fighting Israelites on the ramparts of Jerusalem, and he retreats. You know, it's funny, one of the statistics which always made me, you know, think is that the most amount of Americans killed in any war was in the Civil War, which makes sense because both sides are Americans, right? So if you have Americans fighting against Americans, then everybody's losing, right? So the same kind of thing. David HaMelech said, I'm not going to have Israelite fighting Israelite around Yerushalayim. And he retreats, which is very, very humbling and humiliating to David HaMelech. David HaMelech is now retreating before his son enters Jerusalem. He's moving eastwards towards the Jordan, to where the country Jordan today is, in the East Bank, where he feels he's more secure. And it is during this humiliating retreat that the following incident happens. And here is where we pick up again. Shmuel Beis Perek Tez Zayin. Uvo HaMelech David Ad Bachurim. He comes to an area called Bachurim, moving eastwards. V'inei misham ish yotzei mishpachas Beis Shaul. And there's a man from the tribe of Shaul HaMelech. Ushmo Shimi ben Gera yotzei yotzei mekalel. And this man is coming out and cursing him. V'yisakel b'avonim es David. And he's throwing stones down. You can imagine he's got the higher territories on the side of the mountain. He's throwing stones at David. V'es kol adei HaMelech David v'kol ha'am v'kol ha'giborim yimino v'yismolo. And he's shouting and he's ranting and he's raving at all these people. And this is what he says to David. Listen to the words of his curse. Tzei tzei ish adamim v'ish abri'ayel. Be gone, you man of blood, you cruel, you base fellow. Heshiv olecha Hashem is to call to me, base Shaul. Hashem olachta tachtov. You, Hashem should bring upon you the bloods of the house of Shaul, who you took his place. Vayitaynes Hashem es amlucha b'yala shalom bonecha. And Hashem should take the kingship and give it to your son. You are in your own evil. You are a man of blood. What a terrible curse. If this had been in the presence of the king during his power, it would have been just a matter of seconds before Shimi would have been decapitated. But now he's taking advantage of the king's weakness. And at this point in time, as the king is retreating, that's when he starts levying all these terrible curses. One of the generals, one of his close generals, says to him, who's this dead dog cursing you? Meaning, like, who's nothing, right? And so Avishai has a very simple proposition, a way which usually ends curses quite abruptly. And he says, everyone of our serious Russia, let me just remove his head and then he'll stop cursing you. It's a pretty clean kind of solution. Vayomer HaMelech, Mali v'lochem b'nei Tzruya. What is with you? You sons of Tzruya. Tzruya is the name of the mother of Avishai. Ki yekalel, ko yekalel. This is what he's cursing. Ki Hashem amar lekalel, es David. Mi amar adu asis oken. So who are you to intercede in God's cursing? And that's what happens. And he allows him to curse. And the Pesukim say that Shimi carries on cursing him along the mountaintop as they retreat. Fascinating. So just one interesting point over here, which I thought was fascinating. And that is the words that Shimi uses to curse David is he calls David the Ish Habli'al, the man, the base man, the man who's degraded. Now, that word should ring a bell in our heads because it doesn't happen so many times in Tanakh, but it did just happen in what we read beforehand. If you remember, this was the name given to the group of people who did not pay homage to Shaul HaMelech earlier on. Ubnei Bli'al Omru. That's who the people who did not come to Shaul HaMelech's or accept his coronation. What is Shimi essentially saying about David? Let's understand the curse in a better context now. Shimi, we know, has been identified as coming from the family of Shaul. He's from Binyamin. What's he really saying? David, when my family member, Shaul, was initiated as a king, you are one of the people who never gave him a chance. You are one of those people who scorned him from the outset. You never allowed him to show himself and you always made it that he would never succeed. That's why you bear the responsibility for his failure and you are going to die because the blood of Shaul is on your head. Not because you killed him, but because you started the insurgency against him. That's what essentially is happening. That perhaps what Tanakh is saying in using that word in the way that he curses David. Now, do you notice what is David HaMelech's response? Again, here you have a king in a vulnerable moment in his life. And what's David HaMelech's response? Nothing. Don't do anything. Don't kill him. Is that interesting? It's almost like now the tables are turned. Now David HaMelech is not the one scorning, or not David HaMelech's camp is not the one scorning the new king. He's the king who's being scorned. And he responds in like Shaul, by silence. He doesn't respond. Now, fast forward a few weeks. What happens is that David HaMelech is able to miraculously get to the east bank of the Jordan. He's not killed in his escape. It's a pretty miraculous event. He gets there, his armies return west. They fight against the armies of Avshalom and kill Avshalom against David HaMelech's better wishes. David HaMelech has a very complex relationship with his son. It's his son at the one hand, but it's also his traitor at the other, on the other hand. It's a very complex relationship, not for now. But now, David HaMelech then returns triumphantly to the east, to the West Bank, to Israel proper, of what we have today. He's crossing the Jordan. And now, if you were at this point in time, Shimi ben Gera, what would your course of action be? Right? So I don't know about you, but if I were Shimi ben Gera, I would be making sure that my Algerian passport was still in order. Right? You know, I'm going to be like, okay, now is the right time to get to Ben Gurion and just, you know, silently escape, you know, disappear, name change. Everything's, this is not a good time when David HaMelech walks back into town to be seen. But it's interesting that Shimi ben Gera has a very different course of action. He realizes how vulnerable he is now, and he has what we hear. This is now three chapters later, three prokem later in Tanakh, in Shmuel Beis. We're told the following: the king is coming to the Yarden, he has his entourage, he's going to cross the Jordan, and what happens? Vaymaher, in the seventh source, Vaymaher Shimi ben Gera b'nei minia Shimi b'achorim, Vayeredim ish Yehuda likras ha-melech David. He now goes in front of everybody to go greet David. I mean, this is like putting yourself in front of the train. Ve'elef ishimoi mi Binyamin, he brings 1,000 men of Binyamin. Ve'tzivo nar beis shol, ve'chamesh esesar bono, ve'esrim avodo, ve'itoy ve'tzolcho, yardan yifna ha-melech. And he brings all his folks and all these Benjaminites, and he goes out in front of the king. Ve'avro ha'avoro le'avir es beis ha-melech, ve'asos ha-tov be'enov. And the king's now crossing the Jordan. Ve'shini ben gera nafal ufna ha-melech be'avro ha-yardan. And now he prostrates himself, spread eagle in front of the king, and he says the following. Ve'yomer ha-melech. Don't think too hardly about what I did. We're friends, David. You wouldn't imagine I would say something so nasty about you. But don't take that personally, what your few small words then that were interchanged, you know. You know, it was a mistake. I'm first, I really respect you. That was just, you know, it was a mistake. It was a slip. It was a bad day. It was, you know, Adar Melech, we're all friends. We can all get around this, can't we? So, you know, this is a very dangerous card to be playing, right? The Algeria passport would have been a little safer at this point, but he still comes and he confronts David. And at this point in time, David HaMelech's general has a very, again, his policy is pretty clear here. You know, David HaMelech, just chop off his head right now, let's keep going. You know, so Avishai doesn't stand for these folks. And David HaMelech again turns to his general and says, David, he turns again and he says to Yoav and Avishai, why he includes both of them? Fascinating question. Why are you making an adversary today? Hayom Yomas Ish be Israel, should we kill another Jew? Another Israelite's gonna die in this battle of brother against brother. I know, I'm a king, it's my day of salvation. The king made an oath that he wouldn't kill Shimi. Fascinating. What fascinates me is here you have really essentially the parallel cases in the two consecutive kings of Israel. You have Shaul HaMelech at the moment of vulnerability when he hasn't had a chance to prove himself. There are people who start you know, speaking behind his back, and they don't pay homage to him, and they don't really trust who he is as a king. Shaul HaMelech is silent. He doesn't respond. Then Shaul HaMelech really does become the king. He shows that he can win in battle, and now he has the power, and now has the opportunity, and he has the platform, and he can really kill them. And still, he stops the folks killing those adversaries. Same thing to David. Isn't it amazing? David HaMelech is the most vulnerable point. As an exile from Jerusalem, is now cursed by somebody. He doesn't take an action then. But now when he's back in strength, he's back onto the apex of his power, then the opportunity affords itself a second time. And again, he does not kill his detractor. Amazing, right? So now let's go back to our dichotomy. David HaMelech, but surely we should say the same thing. As an individual, that's fine. But you're not an individual, you're a king. If you're a king, kill him. So the answer is, David HaMelech was a little bit different to Shaul. And that is, if you fast forward a number of years to the end of David HaMelech's life, on his very deathbed, when David HaMelech, at the beginning of Sefer Melachim Aleph, Perek Beis, is talking to his son Shlomo on his deathbed, he has three requests. By the way, he has more requests if you read Devar Hayomim, but he has three requests then, and he has three scores to settle, Barzillai, Yoav, and one of them is Shimi ben Gera. And this is what he says to his son at the beginning of Melachim. Melachim Beis, he says to Shlomo, remember Shlomo HaMelech is only 12 years old at this point in time. He cursed me a terrible curse. who yirad likrosi ayardein v'shavala ba'ashem leimor amitzcha b'acher, and I said I wouldn't kill him. V'ato al t'nakehu, Shlomo, don't acquit him. Ki yish chacham atav yodata es asher ta'aseh. You know what you need to do. V'aradatva es seva soy v'dam sh'ol. Make sure he does not die at a good ripe old age. Which means to say that Dovid for all these years had that vendetta hold standing. He understood that as an individual, I didn't want to kill him. I was able to waive that. I was able to waive my own honor. But as a king, I couldn't. And that at the end of Dovid HaMelech's days, well, there was one thing left in the ledger that Dovid HaMelech needed to settle, and that was Shimi ben Gera, and he settled him. Which leads us to a fascinating point. That Dovid HaMelech was different to Shaul. He did stand for the pride of who the king was. He understood the second hat that he wore, unlike Shaul. He corrected it. But then the question becomes, so why did he wait? If he really understood who he was, then just kill Shimi. I mean, he didn't have to do anything. Avishai was just going to take him aside and kill him right there. He didn't need to even do anything. He just needed to ignore Avishai, and that would have been the end of him. So why would David HaMelech again insist on not killing Shimi? Which leads us to the third and last episode that we're going to consider this evening. And that is the third person we're going to look at, which is Esther Amalka. Now, I'd like to think about this from the following perspective. We've seen two parallel stories. We're now fast-forwarding centuries, folks, right? So these stories do not happen together, but they do converge. These two rivers actually do converge in our story for the following reason. Next Thursday night, God willing, we should all be well. We should all be healthy. We're going to be hearing the Megillah. And there are four psukim which are read aloud by everybody together. And the first of those four psukim, which the Mishnah in Megillah says is shows the significance, it could even be the place where a person needs to hear every word from, according to a minority opinion, is the following pasuk. We say, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shoshana Birah U'Shmo Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Shemini. By the way, the name Shimi should just stand out for us for a moment. We'll hold that there for a moment. But let me ask you a quick question. Which tribe does this man come from? Right, Mordechai, our hero. Which tribe does he come from?
Binyamin.
Good. So it's interesting that whenever you see the phrase in Tanakh, Yemini, a man is a Yemini, it does not refer to the fact that his orientation was a right-handed. Nope. In fact, it refers to the fact that he is a Benjaminite. Now, as an interesting Tanakh trivia, it is actually interesting that many Benjaminites are actually left-handed. In fact, Ehud ben Gera was able to slip his sword into the throne room of Eglon, the king of Moab, because he kept his sword on his right flank because he drew it from the left side. So he got past the metal detectors. So just it happens to be lots of Benjaminites are left-handed men, but they're called Ishimini. I'll just leave that for thoughts as to why that is. The people have been Pelegish Begiva as well, also. Okay. Now, the reason why this is difficult is because there's another word in this pasuk which is a little bit confusing, and that is Yehudi. Now, we say today, very anachronistically, we say, we're all Jews, right? There were no Jews in Egypt. Let me tell you a little secret, right? The Jews did not leave Egypt. The Jews did not get the Torah. You know who did? The Israelites did, right? It started in our, we'll call it our cultural anthropomorphism. In our anthropological development, we started off as Hebrews, Ivrim. Then we were formed into a nation in Egypt. We became Israelites, B'nai Yisrael. And then 1,000 years later, at the times of the Megillah, we started being called Yehudim. And that's the name that we've adopted for the last two millennia, or 2.5 millennia, Yehudi, which is one of the first appearances over here is in the Megillah. And it actually means originally Judean, because the province from which they came, they were exiled by the Babylonians, was Judea. There were two tribes there. There were Benjaminites and Judeans. So let me ask you again now, which tribe does he come from? A little bit confusing. Is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? Remember, there were two groups of Jews who were exiled. The Gemara picks up on exactly this, and the Gemara asks this question. Here's the Gemara on Yud Beis in Megillah. By the way, folks, we're at the crescendo of everything coming together here. So just let's appreciate this Gemara with the context of everything we've learned up till now. So the Gemara says like this. Kari le Yehudi, Amam Yehuda Ka'asi. He's called a Yehudi, so he comes from the tribe of Judah. Kari le Yemini, he's also called a Yemini, Amam Binyamin Ka'asi. It seems like he comes from the tribe of Binyamin. So there are three suggestions that the Gemara makes. The first is a very basic suggestion. Omar Rabba Bar Bar Chana, the Rabba Bar Bar Chana suggests, Omar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, in the name of Yehoshua ben Levi, Avim ben Binyamin, v'imam ben Yehuda. It was a cross marriage, right? Shidduch across the divide. There's one side of the family Yehuda, one side of Binyamin, all happy, happy family. Okay, that's one suggestion. That might be a geological suggestion. It is not a theological suggestion. The next one is just remarkable. Listen to this. Rabbanon Amri, the rabbi suggests, you know why he's got both nationalities appended to him? Mishpachos metagres zubazu. The families in Israel were arguing with one another. Mishpachas Yehuda Omeres, the family of Yehuda, the tribe of Yehuda said, Ana gorim dimisialit Mordechai, delay katilis doveli shibin mingeira. I am the reason, says Yehuda, because our great-great-great-grandfather, David HaMelech, never killed Shimi ben Gera right at the moment that he had the opportunity to, which gave him the space of years to beget a child who begets a child who begets a child who would have a child who would be Mordechai. In other words, the hero of the story is because of our giving him the opportunity. Remember the question was, why did David HaMelech not kill Shimi because of the honor of the crown? He should have killed him right there. The answer is, he knew he needed to wait. Why did he need to wait? Because he needed Shimi to have a child that would ultimately lead to a later redeemer. Amazing. Okay, let's go a little further. And Binyamin says, Mishpachas Binyamin Amra Minai Ka'asim. Binyamin just says, look, if you do the DNA test, it's Benjamin blood in the veins. You know, so whether or not you gave us the opportunity, he still came from us. Now, the last opinion in the Gemara, Rava Amar. Rava says, no, why is there an ambiguity as to which tribe he came from? Knesset Yisrael Amra. It was Israel itself that was arguing, Le'idach Gisa, in the negative. Ru'u ma'asu li'yehudi, u'ma shilem li'yemini. All the nation of Israel at this point was saying, look how terrible these Binyamin and Yehuda are to us. Ru'u ma'asu li'yehudi, u'ma shilem li'yemini. Ma'asu li'yehudi, what did the Judeans do to us? Deloy katilis David l'shimi. Is disyal b'nei Mordechai demikne be'haman. Look what happened. Yehuda was has the leader of who is David. David doesn't kill Shimi immediately. Who comes out of him? Mordechai. Mordechai doesn't bow down to Haman. He created this whole genocide. If David HaMelech had just killed Shimi right there and then, there would be no Mordechai. There was no Mordechai. There'd be no angry Haman. If there's no angry Haman, we would all be fine. We'd be smoking our cigars. Everything would be just all right. That's what the Gemara says. Uma shilim yelimini. But look what the Benjamin did to us. Deloy katilis shol agag. Disyali minei Haman. Dimitzari Yisrael. Then the Jews turned to Binyamin and blamed him and said, you know what? The reason why we have a Haman in the first place is because your ancestor, Shaul, did not kill Agag that critical night. And in the space of time that he had to live, he had a child. And that child ultimately begot a child who begot a child who begot a child who had a child. And that child was Haman the Agagat. Isn't that incredible? The convergence of both these stories. Shaul Zamelech's silence, that space, that weakness in Shaul as a character, created a Haman. David Amelech's weakness, or so to speak, or space, created a Mordechai. And Mordechai is seen in a positive and negative light in this Gemara. Perhaps negative at the beginning of the story and perhaps positive at the end of the story. Right? That would one would have to think about. Is that fascinating? So here we have the convergence of these two silences coming together, but it gets better than that. Now we can finally get, and we can finally put ourselves in tune with one of the most dramatic dialogues that goes on in the entire Megillah. This to me, every time I hear this, it's so powerful, it's so emotional. Mordechai is begging. He's begging Esther to take action. Esther, you're the only one who can do this. You have an in. The king doesn't know who you are. He loves you. You can do this. You're in the right place at the right time. And she doesn't want to, and she's scared, and she knows what's at stake. It's a very difficult position. And finally, he says the words to her as follows in the fourth parak. Ki macharesh tacharishi bo'es hazois. If you will be silent at this time, now let's remember for a second, where does the word lacharish come from? It's a word we've seen before. It's a word, in fact, that Shaul HaMelech used way back when he was insulted by those people who thought that he was not a worthy king. What was the word? It was Vayhi Kamacharish. He was silent. That word does not appear too many times in Tanakh. He was silent. Says Mordechai to Esther, Esther, if you're going to be like that, if you're going to be silent in the face of those who need you to act as a king and not an individual, let's come back to that. Come back to our vote. Bo'ez hazois, at this moment, revach v'atzalo yamod liyudim ha'mokam acher, there's going to be a salvation somehow, by hook or by crook, v'at u'beis ovich tovedu, but you and your father's house will be destroyed. U'mi yodem es kozois higat l'machos. Who knows if you became a queen just for this moment, just for this moment in history. Now that's a little unfair. Why is he bringing her father into this? I mean, that's like a low blow, right? It's like, you should talk to her about her. What's her father's house got to do with this? He's saying your whole father's house will be destroyed. And that's exactly the point. The point is that Mordechai is saying, Esther, you have a great, great ancestor because you come from the tribe of Binyamin like I do. And that great ancestor operated as an individual, even though he was a king. And he wasn't willing to exert himself. And he wasn't willing to stand on principle on the second hat that he wore as a king. But now, Esther, you are no longer a proletariat. You are no longer individual. You wear the crown of a queen. And this is your moment to correct the silence in history made by your ancestor. Because in the space of time that your ancestor was quiet, which kept on happening in his life again and again and again, it created the Haman. You have the opportunity now to close that gap and not be silent and ultimately resurrect the legacy of Beis Avich, or your father's house. Isn't that incredible? That's what Mordechai is really saying to her. And Mordechai knows, because he came to be in the gap of silence of a David Melech who understood this, who understood on the one hand, you have to be a good human being. You not have to retaliate, but at being as a king, one has to at a later point. But he gave the space for Mordechai to exist. And this is what the Midrash Yalkut Shimoni suggests. Rabbi Yeshua Bachrach in his Sefer on Megillah points to this very beautiful Midrash. He says, Yizal Mayim Midalyot. This is a blessing from, this is the last thing we'll do. This is a blessing from Bilam to Israel in Parshas Balak, where he says, listen to these four enigmatic poetic lines. Yizal Mayim Midalyot. Water will flow from his bucket. Zaroi b'mayim rabim, and his seed will be in constant flowing water. V'yarom me'agag malkoi, and he will ascend from Agag as a king. V'atinasei malkosoi, and his kingship will be ascended. Very strange, very enigmatic. What is it referring to? The Medrash takes each part of this pasuk, each of the four parts of this stanza, and breaks it up for us. Here's what the Medrash says. Yizal mayim midalyav, the first part of the pasuk, which says that water will flow from his buckets. Ze malchusoi shel Shaul kidli shiyesh lo hefsek. Meaning, this is the referring to the kingship of Shaul, which it wasn't constantly flowing. If you want the water to flow, you have to keep filling up the bucket and pushing more, and filling up the bucket and pushing more there. With Zarah b'mayim rabbi, in the second part of the stanza, his seed with over many water. Ze malchus based obi she'en lo hefsek lo lamvoyen. It's more like the image of a river. So as opposed to having to keep filling the bucket, the river keeps flowing. Two very different images. What stopped the Malchus of Shaul? What made the Hefsek? Answer is Agag, Shenema v'yarom me'agag malko, third part of the stanza, that his kingship was ascended because of Agag. That's what made him lose it, and that was that weakness in him. Af al pichein, the resolution of this tension in the stanza is Choseres v'niseis al yedei Esther, Shenema v'atinosei malchusoi. This last part of the pasuk, v'atinosei malchusoi, that his kingship will be ascended, comes back to Esther, who is able to reestablish the kingship of Shaul HaMelech, that person who has the moral high ground, but also the realization of who he or she is as a person. If you think about this in the larger context of history, we're talking about a millennia, essentially, or shy of a millennia, of the time it takes for this person or this Malchus to really recognize who it is that they are. And that's, I think, a journey that we all go through in life. The journey of understanding who we are as individuals, refining our characters, but also realizing the other hats that we have to wear in life. This is perhaps a perspective I found which is fascinating. Now, I see a number of questions. And let's go back to some of these questions quickly now. So why do the people talk to Shmuel and not to Shaul? Okay, so at this point in time. So that's a good question. I do not know the answer offhand, but I would imagine that the person they trust is Shmuel, right? So the person they've always looked to as the leader is Shmuel, so they're always going to be the one they talk to. Let me just see which pasuk you're referring to. I'm El Shmuel. Yes. So I think that's coming back to the fact that the leader they always trusted was Shmuel, even when Shaul has already showed himself. So it sort of goes to the fact that it's a very hard weaning process to this new type of leadership. So Elaine, thank you. Good question about David HaMelech not killing his enemies right away. You're 100% right, and that's exactly the point. Okay, and he killed them later on. Okay, over here. Okay, Tzvi, I think it depends on the situation. Is there a chance of having a peaceful dialogue? Okay, yes, it would be worth answering to bring peace. If there's no chance of having a peaceful dialogue, then one should be quiet. Yes, so 100%. Every situation is different. Right, I mean, so there's going to be times where dialogue is appropriate. I'll just give an interesting point. A perspective is that, you know, with Pinchas, when it came to the way that Pinchas dealt with problems, right? The first time you meet Pinchas dealing with problems is in Parshas Balak and Pinchas, where he murders the problems, right? So that's the way he deals with it. But it's interesting later on in Shiyoshua Perek Chav Aleph, when he deals with problems, he uses diplomacy, right? So it's important to appreciate that not every not every situation calls for the same type of approach. And Pinchas is able to straddle both of those. So yes, you're 100% right. Dialogue is very important. iPad said the dissenters could have been brought forth into Shaul and Shmuel and asked or forced to swear loyalty and not be killed. That's a very good call. I don't know why or not. It's just militarily, just at this point in time, just to realize Israel had very little weaponry, they had very little organization, they didn't have any centralization, so it was much harder to get to this point. But yes, it probably was. I think part of the question that what was really going on over here, that Shimi was cursing David about, was he believed that David was part of the dissenters, whether or not that's true. And he felt that there wasn't a system in place to be able to actually round them all up. So unfortunately the embers of that ultimately left. So that is a very good point. Tova points out, but on David's death, but he tells Shlomo to take revenge on Shimi. Excellent. Good. So you're right. 100% right. So David HaMelech's revenge to Shimi on the one hand is as a calculated action rather than a visceral response. So as an individual, he wasn't responding right away, but as a leader, he had to, and he waited and calculated when that would be. Yael, was Avimelech learning to control his passions, which had led him to this? And that's a very fascinating suggestion. I think there's a lot of meaning to that. So it could be that this is a good example of David HaMelech being able to stay and not necessarily just act on the situation right now, which might be a good example of David HaMelech actually coming through. And this is an expression of growth rather than a sign of weakness as well. So I think that's an excellent point as well. Wow, this is fantastic. Thank you, everybody, so much for being here, for these very thoughtful questions and perspectives.
Thank you very much. I believe Rabbi Trump has a meeting that he said he has to go to, so I don't want to keep him too long for people who have questions. Eddie wants finished by 9:30, but really want to thank you for that very interesting and original, the lumina of bringing everything all together. Yasher koach, and we look forward to learning with you again in the future, and all the best. I want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom, and we'll let you go.